Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Pratitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Verse 7. Yathanekas chakshu prakasho ravirna. Yathaneka chakshush prakasho ravirna. Kramena prakashi karoti prakasham. Kramena prakashi karoti prakasham. Aneka dhiyo yas tataika prabodaha. Aneka dhiyo yas tataika prabodaha. Sanityo palabdi svarupo hamatma. Sanityo palabdi svarupo hamatma. Sandhi. Yata aneka chakshus prakashaha ravihi na kramena prakashi karoti prakasham anekaha dhiyaha yas yaha tatha eka prabodhaha saha nitya upalabdhi swarupaha aham atma. There's a doubt in the Shankara Bhasha to the verses. Shankara will often introduce each verse with a doubt or a question that leads into the verse. And so this doubt, what he has to say is, how can one self, one Atma, simultaneously be the presiding deity or the self of many minds? Another way of saying it, how can one Atma be the presiding deity, the consciousness, the one that illumines aneka dhiyaha, many minds, more than one mind? And the logic, he goes, why does this seem complex? He goes, well, we all know that only one, if somebody is a ashwasadi, if somebody is riding a horse, mounted on a horse, right, they can only be mounted on one horse at a time, not simultaneously. Person can't be the ruler or the presiding deity, the one who supervises or governs the behavior, is the conscious ruler of more than one horse at a time, not simultaneously. They could do it kramena. Kramena means sequentially. Now I ride this horse, and I'm directing this horse. Now I ride this horse, I'm directing this horse. No way to do all of these things, to be the adhishtatra, means the presiding deity, the conscious being, right, for many horses at the same time. We all know that. So we see that, you know. So when that's the case, and at the same time, we know clearly they can't do it simultaneously. We know clearly that they can do it sequentially, right, one at a time. We all know that. So, but here, that's not so. Because here the Atma is simultaneously, right, simultaneously governs, or is the presiding deity, the consciousness of all the buddhis at one time, all the intellects, all the minds at one time, not sequentially. So then he says, the Atma can't do this simultaneously. It must do it sequentially. It's not possible, he says. Therefore, there's not one Atma. Because we see from horseback riding, right? You can only ride and you can only be the thing that impels a given object or causes a different a given object to perform in a particular way, one thing at a time. So therefore, because we see that in the world so clearly, it must be that it's not that there's one Atma, there's many Atmas. It means that every buddhi, every intellect has a self, not just one self, that is the presiding deity of all of the minds simultaneously. So obviously, there can't be just one self. So somebody having that doubt, this verse is in response to that. And so he says, just as yata, just as the ravihi, ravi means the aditya, the sun. So just as the sun, okay, which is the prakasha, which is the light for many eyes, aneka means many, aneka chakshus, for many eyes. So just as the sun, which is the light for many eyes, not just one, right? That sun, which is the light for many eyes, does not sequentially, na kramena, it does not sequentially illumine prakashi karoti. It does not sequentially illumine the prakasham, all the things that are lit up. Right? So just as the sun, which is the luminary for many eyes, does not sequentially light up all of the objects that are there lit. Prakasham means those things that have been illumined. So just as the sun does not do that sequentially, aneka dhiyaha yaha tata eka prabodha, the one consciousness, similarly, in the same way, the consciousness which is one, does not sequentially, na kramena, light up all of the given buddhis. Aneka dhiyaha is, for the Sanskrit students, is a feminine nouns in the accusative plural, which can be kind of they look like nominatives, but they're actually accusative plural in the feminine. So anekaha di, aneka is an adjective. So anekaha dhyaha yaha tata eka prabodha. The word prabodha means knowledge. Knowledge and consciousness, awareness are all used synonymously. We say jnanam, atma jnanam, it's self-knowledge, but the knowledge is, sense of a capital K, is used as the same in the sense of knowledge as awareness. Awareness or chaitanya or consciousness. Okay, so the eka prabodha, that one knowledge, that one consciousness, in the same way as the sun lights up all of the objects and lights up, provides the light for all of the eyes, and is the luminary for all the things that are lit up, like that one consciousness lights up all of the minds, all of the thoughts in the mind. Sanitya upalabdhi swarupaha aham atma. Aham atma. I am that self whose swarupa, whose nature is the consciousness, right? Upalabdhi, consciousness, which is nitya, which is timeless. I am the self whose swarupa, whose nature is timeless, changeless consciousness. That consciousness which lights up all the buddhis, all of the intellects, all of the minds simultaneously, not one at a time. So that means that the one Atma that I am, the one self that I am, so let's try to get a little image of this, okay? There's two factors. The next verse will go into this some also. There's two things to consider here. My mind, means each one of our minds, right? Say, through the sense organs, is gaining a thought modification that can be whatever the perception happens to be, or whatever the imagination happens to be, whatever the thought happens to be, the memory, the feeling. There is a thought modification, okay? That thought modification, in this case, we're calling it prakasham, that which is illumined, right? So whatever thought you have, that thought is illumined. And what is the cause for the illumination of that thought? What makes that thought known? What makes that thought be illumined, be known, shine in awareness? What makes that thought be something which exists in consciousness? And all of these words are just saying the same thing. I've just said the same thing about five times. Okay. in using different language, the thought is known. The thought is in consciousness. The thought is illumined. What is the cause for that illumined nature of the thought? What is it that illumines it? That which illumines it, ahamasmi, I am that Atma, which is the timeless consciousness, which is the Eka, which is the Eka Prabodha, the one consciousness, which is myself, my very Swarupa, which is consciousness, that consciousness which is free from time, Nitya. Nitya Upalabdhi Swarupaha Ahamatma. I am that Atma whose Swarupa, whose nature is changeless consciousness. That consciousness which illumines, is the very consciousness which illumines the buddhi, right? Which illumines the mind, that allows the mind to be known. Now, the minds by their nature are continually changing. Vritti, vritti, vritti. Vritti means thought modification. Thought after thought after thought after thought. And all of those thoughts, as they come, one after another, after another, after another, remains illumined. Or whatever condition, whatever thought is there, the thought is illumined. The luminosity of the thought is constant. Thought goes on changing, but the illumined nature of the thought remains the same. Right? And so, that being so, that which causes the luminosity of the thought, the knownness of the thought, doesn't belong to the thought. Because the thought goes out of knownness. It comes into being known. It comes into that prakasham, that being illumined. Comes into being illumined, goes out of being illumined. Doesn't stay illumined. How do you know that? Well, you don't know it anymore. Right? Well, it's not in your consciousness. Right? It comes into consciousness, goes out of consciousness. When it's in consciousness, I'm conscious of it. It's known. That's when we say it's illumined. When it's out of consciousness, it's not known. Okay? Now, so the thoughts come into consciousness and out of consciousness. That which illumines the thought, the consciousness itself, that doesn't come into consciousness and out of consciousness. That's the consciousness that remains the same. Right? The thought comes into the consciousness, goes out of the consciousness, the thought remains the same. Now that's just my individual, the consciousness remains the same. Everybody with me on this? So my consciousness remains the same, illumining the thoughts that come and go. The illumined remains, the thoughts come into the being illumined. Do you understand that? What allows the thoughts to be illumined, that remains. The thought comes there, it's illumined. Next thought comes, it's illumined. Next thought comes, it's illumined. So, this illumining one, the Nitya Upalabdhi Swarupa, the consciousness that's not changing, we have to say that that conscious being is asangaha, means it's not attached. It's asanga. Asanga means not attached. It's not attached to what comes and goes. Right? It starts free of what comes and goes. Do you see that? If what comes and goes, and it doesn't, then it's asangaha. It's not attached. So whatever is, in fact, prakasham, whatever is illumined, right, is different from the luminary. Because what is gains the status of being illumined is not the luminosity itself. If I say illumined, that means it's dependent upon the luminosity. If it's something which is an object of another language, if I say it's an object of awareness, it's not the awareness itself. Or it's an object of awareness. It's dependent on awareness for it to be known. That's what I mean by that. That means if it goes out of awareness, then it's gone. But awareness... awareness itself is always known, not as an object, but as its very nature, as its very swarupa. Awareness itself is the experience of being known. Right? That's its own experience. That's its nature. That's its own. I would say like this. The sun, the Ravi. The Ravi itself, the sun itself, its swarupa is luminosity, heat. Okay? It doesn't need something to come and warm it up. It doesn't need that because it already is that. In fact, anything comes and tries to warm it up, that'll just be sizzled by the heat of the sun, right? So nothing's going to be able to heat up the sun. The sun already is the heat. It already is the light. Nothing can really come and illumine the sun any more than it's illumined. It's the master luminary in the creation. Okay? So nothing can add to that. That's its very swarupa. And so it itself is the experience of heat. It is the experience of light. Nothing can add to it. Nothing need add to it. Awareness is the experience of awareness. Right? It is the experience of consciousness, not consciousness of something, but consciousness is its very being, its very swarupa, its very nature. And so, we always think of consciousness in like this, conscious of something. You know, that's what we're conscious of that. That's what we mean by the word. But now what we're doing is trying to help you to recognize the nature of consciousness itself. Because actually, the objects of consciousness are just illumined. They're the illumined ones. So, and those illumined ones pass through. They come and go, and they come and go, and they come and go. Consciousness is the luminary, which is its own experience, its own being. That's why we say consciousness, your being, your sense of self, is swaprakashitvam, it's self-luminous. Swata siddha, it's self-evident. It's its own. I am my own experience. Nobody's lighting me up. I am my own consciousness, not somebody, not dependent on anything else. And my being, this me, the self that I am, it is the luminary which lights up this mind, which has no attachment and has no attachment to this mind or to any thing that's illumined, right? Because how could the luminary be attached to what is illumined? It's kind of apples and oranges in a way. There's no way for the luminary to be attached to what it illumines. The luminary is its own experience. Consciousness is its own experience, and it is changeless in terms of itself, but also changeless in terms of what is illumined. That's why everything comes and goes in consciousness, and consciousness doesn't come and go. That's true for me. But if I am a sangha, if I am not attached to my thoughts or moods or feelings or anything objectifiable by them, if I'm not attached to the sense organs, which are illumined, I'm not attached to the body, which is illumined, I'm not attached to the world, which is illumined, right? All of these things are illumined, and they come and go. They're in constant flux. I'm not attached to these things. Not, I mean, by attached, I mean, I don't mean attached as, oh, I'm really attached to my child, or I'm really attached to my partner, or I'm really attached to my car. I mean that kind of attachment. I mean literally attached. You know, like connected, physically connected. My being is not attached to anything, right? Because everything comes and goes in me. I'm the constant. Nor am I an object that I illumine. I'm the luminosity itself and the consciousness itself. I'm not an object that I'm illuminating. I'm the consciousness itself. That being so, how can there be two of me? How can I be two? Who is the second going to be? Who is the second going to be? We can say there are many prakashas, many things that are illumined, right? And those things that are illumined, one is different from the other, right? Like, that painting is different from that painting. This person is different from this person. It's this person. This mind is different from this mind, this mind, this mind, this mind. All of these are, yes, different from each other, but they're all luminaries. They're all illumined. Illumined, I mean. And so how does the almost countless multidimensional differences of all of these illumined things, how does that differentiate me? How does that make me, too, the one who is the conscious being that's the luminary? What is going to divide that self? So I say that Atma, this Atma that I am, the conscious being that I am, the luminary, right? The one because of whom all things are known, because of whom every mind is illumined as it is known, it is known, it is known. Whatever thought you have, just by its nature, it is known. You won't have a thought that is not known. Imagine that. You have a thought, and it's not a known thought. No. Every thought you have is known. But what is the source of its knownness? That is me. That's the Atma. And that self is not two. Right? That self illumines all. Now, the question is, yeah, how can it do that? Why, if it illumines all, does it illumine them all one at a time? Like, say you've got, 4 million minds or 4 billion trillion minds or whatever, and the Atma is going ding, 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 lightning. Now, just like the sun, right, is the light that illumines all eyes and all objects of knowledge simultaneously, right? It allows the light that allows for all of the eyes to see things simultaneously. Like that, my being allows, is the light, is the consciousness that allows all the jivas, all the beings, to be known. We don't really think about it like that. That word doesn't always work very well. But when you think about it, everything that makes you a unique jiva individual is known. Everything. Your body is known. It's a prakasha. It's illumined, right? Just like the painting is illumined, the rug is illumined, the body is illumined. It's known through your 5 sense organs. That's how you even know you have a body. That's the only reason you know you have a body is through your 5 sense organs. What other contact you have with it. It'll eliminate the sense organs one by one. And your body goes, say you get rid of your eyes, for instance, all color is gone, but you still see your body. All forms are gone. Can't perceive any forms, but I still see my body. No, you don't. If you lose your eyes, you don't see color, you don't see form, which includes this physical body. If you lose your ears, you don't hear sound, and you don't hear your sound of your physical body either, because you don't have any ears. Right? If you lose your sense of taste, taste is gone, period. Your body has no taste, and neither does anything else. Gone. Lose your sense of touch. That is a major one. Not only if you lose your sense of touch, you not only can't feel objects outside of the body, you can't feel your body either. You feel your body through the sense of touch. So your contact with this object is through the 5 sense organs. Just like your contact with the physical world, external to the body, is through your 5 sense organs. Right? So this body, this physical body, is an object that belongs to the universe, as do all other bodies. And this body, like all other things in the universe, are known to the 5 sense organs. Now your 5 sense organs, they are also objects which are known. You know if they're working, you know if they're not working, you know what they're seeing, what they're hearing, what they're doing. They're objects. And if one doesn't work, it's not that you've lost yourself, you've lost your sense of sight. It's not that you've lost yourself, you've lost your hearing. So you've lost an instrument. And you know that you've lost that instrument. So these are all known. Your thoughts. Your thoughts are known. Right? They're prakasha. These are illumined, your thoughts, your emotions, right? Your moods, all of your memories, your dreams, your fantasies, and all of your heavy thinking, all the thinking we do, right? All known. The I thought, I am doing such, I am thinking, I am trying to learn, I'm a mukshu, I am this, I am that, I'm that. Known, these are all illumined. all of them, everything, everything that makes a jiva, an individual living being, a jiva, is known. And all these known jivas, all of these body, mind, sense organ complexes, all are part of the known creation. Right? Like, if I look at this room and I see all of you sitting in this room, you're all sitting in the room. You're living objects in the room. I tend to forget that I'm also a living object in the room. Right? It's not like everybody else is just an object in the universe, a sentient being in the universe. I'm also a sentient being in the universe. My body, my sense organs, my mind belongs to this universe as well as everybody else's body, mind, sense organs. All illumined. The Atma, you, are not illumined. You are the luminosity. You're the awareness. You can say, I am self-illumined. I am the luminous experience. I am the experience of luminosity. I am the experience of awareness. As long as you understand, if you use words like that, I am the experience of awareness. I am the experience of awareful existence, awareness which is being. You can use those words. As long as you understand that the being awareness that you are is not an experience that you are having as an object, as though there's someone behind the experience. That self-experience is the bottom line. There's nothing behind it. Nor is it objectifiable in the subject-object, where you look at, here's this awareness that I am. Here's this existence. No, I am that. There's no subject-object there. Everything else is illumined. This is the conscious being because of which I'm the conscious being because of which they're all illumined. So that being so, where I'm not illumined as an object, I'm the luminary, I'm the consciousness itself, the me, what will make me different from you? What will make there two? We say, there's not two. Because for there to be two, I have to be illumined. I have to be an object that can be differentiated. And how can awareness be divided? What's going to divide it? The body is illumined. Space? Space divides it. Space is illumined. Space is known. You can be without space. Shut your eyes. Go to sleep. Meditate. Space is an element of the creation. Space, air, fire, water, earth. It's illumined. It's known. Something that is illumined can't divide the luminary. So if even space is illumined, time is illumined because change is illumined. Time and change go together. Where they stop change, you stop time. So how to divide this conscious being that I am, that is present, and the luminary of every experience that I have, the self, the consciousness, the me that's present to every single experience that I have. I can't attach it to my changing experiences. I can't experience any change within myself. And so there's that asangaha there. And so then how can I say that this I is two? Which means that the I, this me experience, when you say me right now, me, I, the conscious being that I take to be myself, that is usually identified with the body and the mind, sense organs, but this me, what it boils down to is that it is this me, the one that illumines this mind, is the one that illumines this mind, and this mind, and this mind, and this mind. The one that illumines and is the self of this body. The one that's the self, the me, of this body and mind is the self of this body and mind and this body of mind and this body and mind. There's only one self. And that self, which is me, is the self that every mind, right, enjoys, that causes every mind to be known, right? Because every thought is known. So it's this me, that is me, that it causes every mind to be known. And then because the self-ignorance is there, every mind that is known says, I am the self. I am the self. I am the self. I am the self. Not realizing that it's the illumined, right? And it's truly not away from the self, but the self is the one who is asangaha, unattached and present to every thought that is there for this mind, for that mind, and for that mind, and for that mind. What's so wonderful about that is that in that, and when you get it, when you understand that, is that you know very intimately who everyone is. You know who everyone is. You know who your cat is. You know who your pets are. You know who the mice are. You know who the mosquitoes are. You know who the good people are and the bad people are. You know who they are in terms of their being. And then as you start understanding what causes the different minds to behave differently, for some minds to be in so much pain, for some minds to be so happy, for some minds to be so hurtful and aggressive, and other minds to be gentle, etc. What is it, you know, that allows some minds to reflect the self, or see so peaceful and gentle, and other minds to be so unhappy? It all comes down to ignorance and the effects of ignorance. How we respond to self-ignorance. That's what it amounts to. How do all the different minds respond to their experience with self-ignorance? The culprit here is self-ignorance. The culprit, the self-ignorance, is what causes me to take myself as a separate mortal being, subject to death, searching the world and manipulating the world for my fullness, completeness, for my happiness. That's the ignorance, right? And there's no human being that does not want to be whole and complete. Another language we can say, there's no human being that doesn't want to be myself. I want myself back. I want to be me. I don't want to feel divorced from myself. Yeah. And because of the self-ignorance, right, we do feel divorced from ourselves, except when I get a moment of peacefulness in my mind, right, and then I get a semblance, just what we call alesha, just a semblance, a smallest little piece of a smallest little lesha, little segment of peacefulness, of wholeness, which is simply caused by, for instance, when I fulfill a desire. If I just fulfill a desire, that's the easiest way to do it, and that's what, you know, most people try to do, is to fulfill a desire, and that's where the belief is. If I could just have that thing, I would be happy. And it can get very intense. I have to have that to be happy. And if you try to take it away from me, I'll blow your brains out. And it can get to that extent. Because it's not all right for me not to be happy. And this is the great delusion. If I fulfill a desire, especially if I really want it, at that moment, the mind becomes desireless. It becomes quiet. And in that quietude, like the sun reflecting a clear bucket of water, how it resonates in that mind. For that moment, my mind is out of the way. It is not a problem. And I feel whole and complete just for the moment. You know, because it doesn't last very long. My mind will think up another desire soon. But I do feel whole and complete for the moment. And I spend, for somebody with self-ignorance, until you gain knowledge, you spend your lifetime manipulating your experiences in order to get that moment of peace. You may do it in different ways. Like drug addicts might do it through taking drugs. Criminals or mafiosos might do it from knocking this guy off or knocking that guy off and getting a bunch of money and drinking or whatever and getting a moment of quietude. Whatever they do. You might do it through meditative exercises. You know? Or through macrobiotics. Or through charities. Or through Dharma, the practice of Dharma, the practice of kindness. That's a kind of a more, I would say, sophisticated understanding of the creation and of the more you give, the more you receive. More sophisticated understanding of what all the religions in the world teach, which is really the golden rule. Ahimsa, non-injury, given to others and, you know, do to others as you would have done to yourself. People who are mature, psychologically mature, spiritually mature, understand this through their life experience, that the more you give, the more you love, the more you help others, the more peace, inner peace you feel. It's a law. But what I'm doing, still at this level, I am behaving in the creation in a way that gives me peace. I've learned it. If I behave like this, right, my mind will be peaceful. So I am still at this level, even though there's a lot of grace and beauty in it and a depth of truth, because that behavior is in harmony with the way the creation works. I'm still manipulating the creation to give me elation, a little semblance of happiness or joy based, dependent upon my good behavior. And that good behavior continues to increase and become better and better and better. The more dharmic I become, the more caring I become, the more I give. And so that it also has its own reward. Well, let me give more then, because there's more depth of joy there. So I'll give more and I'll give more. And you learn to give, you know, to be good. Because really there's so much grace in that. It's a better way to be, just through your experience. But we're still, in a sense, dependent upon the world and on our activities to give us that experience. I'm still dependent on the world to give me that experience. Now what about this? What if I even go another notch? Let me meditate. Let me just spend all of my time meditating. Let me do deep breathing exercises, which are extremely effective. Let me live a dharmic life, try to give and to be kind so that I have a relatively peaceful mind. Okay, so let me do that. Eat well. Have a comfortable, do enough exercise so I have a comfortable body, to have a comfortable asana position. And then let me meditate, relax my body, do breathing exercises in order to, which are very effective for absorbing the mind, maybe do some japa, the repetition of a mantra, in order to bring my mind into a state of deep quietude, deep peace, deep absorption, deep freedom from the moment of wanting anything, because it just has stilled the mind. And then in that situation, I can enjoy peace. Swamiji used to do this much more dramatically than I'm doing it now, but he would do it. So he would do this. Then he'd put us in the in this deep state in the middle of the Himalayas and with a beautiful asana, yeah, sitting there. in deep meditation, really enjoying it until mosquito. I don't know if how many of you have been to India, but even if you're sitting in meditation, you need a mosquito net. Right? but the thing is, yes, you're still, in a sophisticated way, needing to bring your mind into a condition for it to have a certain experience. And so, once again, you're dependent, that's why we say lesha. This is just a lesha, just a sliver of the fullness that you are. Because that fullness that you are, it is now just that which is reflected in the mind as an experience. You've not recognized yet your nature. The one who's there meditating. The one who illumines the meditative mind. The one that illumines the acts of goodness. The one that illumines the selfish acts. The one that is there, always, whether you're meditating, whether you're not meditating, whether you're eating or drinking or sleeping or whatever the heck you're doing, it makes no difference to the wholeness and completeness of your being. It is not dependent on anything. That's what the self that needs to be known. And once a person knows that, then you're freed from this samsara. That I have to do this in order to be happy, or I have to do that in order to be happy. I have to do this, and I have to act like this in order to be happy. Those actions of being a good person and all of that, that is normal. It is normal to be a loving, kind person. You're not loving and kind when you're threatened by something. Something, you're threatened in some way. Someone, somehow, is trying to take your happiness away from you. That's why you become selfish or small or all of these qualities that we don't like. All of these qualities that we shun and we don't want to be like that, try to get rid of them in ourselves. Really, all of them are rooted in ignorance. They're not rooted in good or evil or anything like that. They're rooted in self-ignorance. When that self-ignorance is not there, and your mind therefore isn't seeking an experience, but is simply actually totally at home with yourself, because there's no time that the mind's away from the self. It doesn't have to work for that experience. When is your mind away from yourself, from your own being? What work does it have to do? How does it have to maintain it? Do you have to maintain being in your own presence? You tell me when you're not. Does the mind light up your presence, or does your presence light up the mind? Well, my mind's always in my presence, but it has to light it up. No, that's not right. You light up the presence. You are the presence that is lighting up the mind. You are the presence that's lighting up the unhappy mind, and you're the presence that's lighting up the happy mind. The jnani is the one that relaxes in that presence. If the mind is upset because of some trauma that it's going through in the world and got caught up in something, it can just relax in the self. Your self is not caught up. It's never caught up. And so when that is known, right, when one has that knowledge, then you're not threatened. And so it's not a big deal to be a good person. To say the saintly person is so profoundly kind. Do you think they're working at it? Mm-mm. It's natural. And it's not natural just for a saintly person. It's natural for a human being that isn't being threatened. But for a human being not to be threatened is a big deal. Because everything about the jiva, that which is known, is by the very nature of the creation threatened. Right? After all, this body is definitely fragile and finite and could pop at any minute. Anything could happen. Right? any object that I consider to be an object that makes me happy could be destroyed at any time, taken away. If the object happens to be a person, they could take themselves away at any time. You tell me where is the security? So then if you even look at in relative existence, the less a person is attached to objects in the world as opposed to being attached to their own inner value system, things like that, the more peaceful they are. Because the value system is less fragile, right, than the objects. So say, for instance, let me give you an example. Say you have learned, just from your experience in the world, from teaching, from spiritual paths, so many different things, you have learned that that it's more important for you, for your own sake, for your own happiness, to follow dharma, to follow whatever do the dharma in a given situation, rather than what is immediately pleasurable. Say that's not just because you're being a goody-goody, you know, but because you've truly understood that the experience of happiness and well-being you get from that behavior is far superior than choosing the more immediately pleasurable path. You know it. It's knowledge. You understand it, right? When that's true for you, right, then your peace of mind is much more constant or stable than if you're going after immediate pleasures. Because your attachment is more to the dharma, which is not fluctuating as much as immediate pleasures are fluctuating. So you enjoy more peace like that. So that's a maturity that takes place. Nevertheless, it's still bound in samsara. But this level of samsara is what the Vedas, the Karmakanda, all the scriptures of the world are trying to teach you. Is as a samsari, as somebody who doesn't have self-knowledge, you know, who takes yourself to be the body, mind, sense organs, you're identified with what is illumined, this is the way to do it. Because this is the way that will give you some type of stability. But what is self-knowledge? Self-knowledge goes it's a different step. Now it's a different understanding. It's the understanding of yourself, the one who is not the illumined, but is the very stable being that can never not be stable. The being that is always constant, that is always the same, that you can't do anything about yourself. You can't change yourself. You can't make yourself better. You can't make yourself worse. You are, period. And you are whole and complete by your very swarupa. This swarupa, by your very nature. And so this me, which is the one self in all beings, it is this me that illumines everything that my mind needs to recognize in the sense of differentiating from itself all of the changing vrittis and thoughts that are going on that make up the mind. It needs to differentiate itself from my own presence. And that, then, is really moksha. Because there's no maintenance. There's no maintenance. The self needs no maintenance whatsoever. And the mind needs no maintenance. That's the, you know, tremendous power of ignorance and removal of ignorance. Right? If the ignorance is removed that caused the mind to identify your being with itself and therefore with everything finite, once that ignorance is removed and the self is known, then how are you going to not know that? Right? You can't get that ignorance back, is the thing. And so your mind may behave habitually as an ajnani, habitually in silly ways for a while, but just because of lifetimes of habitual behavior. Right? However, yourself is illumining that, and you are the self. That's the difference. If you know, if you use the sun example, the sun illumining the three water buckets, like you hear where Estelle Malik is always talking about the sun in these verses. If you think of the sun illumining the three water buckets, where's your identify? Where's the identity for the ahankar, the I notion? Are you the sun? Or are you the reflection of the sun? Who are you? If you're the reflecting, if you think you're the reflection of the sun, then it's really important that that water be calm. If you're the sun, then the sun is illumining exactly the same all the time, and sometimes illumining the still water, sometimes illumining the muddy water, sometimes illumining the agitated water, you know, but I'm always the same. That being so, so the ahankara, the I notion, is with me, the sun, the one that is the luminary, the one that illumines as the conscious being present, always the same in the mind, right? That's me. And then when the mind is quiet, then that mind has an experience of joy or happiness or bliss or ananda, fullness, because the mind is quiet and it reflects me. It's not in the way. And so it has a joyful experience, which we love, right? But for the samsari, that's all they have. That's it. Always working for these little joyful experiences that are nothing. They're nice and all that, but that's their nothing. They're nothing because they come and go. So who cares? You know, that's when Swamiji tells this story about the guy in the ocean who's drowning. Right? He's drowning, and the undertow, you know, keeps pulling him down and then pushing him up. Pulling him down and pushing him up. And he's so relieved every time he gets, the undertow pushes him up, you know, and he gets, takes a breath of air, and, you know, he's just so happy he gets to breathe. But then the undertow pulls him down again. He just goes on, like that, on. Finally, after a time, you know, he gets up and, for the air, and he thinks, who cares? You know, I have 5 seconds of air to be pulled down again. Please take me to the shore. Bhagavan, please rescue me. Take me to the shore. This 5 seconds of air is no good. You know? And I think, you know, that's what happens to a mumukshu. This 5 seconds of happiness is not good. This 5 seconds, you know, of feeling that all is well with me isn't enough. That's samsara. 5 seconds of happiness. 5 seconds of feeling, oh, this is, oh, everything's great. 5 seconds. You know? That's not what we want. We want to be whole and complete. Period. No 5 seconds. No time. We don't want time. I want to be whole, full and complete. And then let, you know, happy experiences, sad experiences, and world. Let the world be the world. I'm not asking the world to change. It could be what it is. But I want to be free. And that means I don't want to be in this samsara. I don't want to be drowning in the ocean. I want to be pulled off to the shore. Right? That pulling off to the shore has nothing to do with maintaining a state of mind. Right? That trying to maintain a state of mind is like the 5 seconds. If you think, you know, then you become a mental maintenance person, maintenance man of the mind. We don't want to be a maintenance man of the mind. We want to be free. And so the mind is what the mind is what the mind is. What causes the mind to have all of this sorrow and agitation in the first place? What causes it to get so upset, to get so hurt, to get so wounded, to get in such despair? What causes that? Well, briefly, what causes it is self-ignorance. And that self-beginningless self-ignorance, it's not like, oh, I hate myself because I'm self-ignorant. You've never not been self-ignorant. Every human being is self-ignorant until they gain self-knowledge. It's beginningless. If there's a beginning to ignorance, then you'd had self-knowledge before you became ignorant. So ignorance is beginningless. But it comes, you know, it comes to an end. But until it comes to an end, what is what causes the despair and the hurt and the sadness is that I need this or this or this to be happy. I need something external to my being to be whole and complete. And that doesn't always work out. It really doesn't. And I can be very wounded by those things not working out, especially if you go into childhood situations and all the horrors that can happen in the world. The mind gets tied into knots, trying to make things work out so that it can have an experience of happiness. That little 5 seconds. I could just have that 5 seconds. Because we don't think of it like that. We don't want it to only be 5 seconds. If I could just have, this would just happen, then I would feel loved. Then I would be loved. Then I would be cared for. Then I would be worthwhile. All of these things. You know, all of them are, because of self-ignorance, have been, we search in the world for them. And then often the people and the situations that we think that we want or are in a position to provide that illusory happiness for us don't even provide the illusory happiness. They don't do their job. They don't do what they're supposed to do. And then we can just get crushed. I don't get crushed. The self does never gets crushed. But the mind gets crushed. It gets so hurt. And we have to spend all this time unraveling that. And that's our task. Now, when we come to knowledge, when a person's a mumukshu, and they come to this knowledge, for us, just because I say we're in Kali Yuga, if I want to just make a blanket statement, we're in a difficult era. A lot of adharma. Walking underwater, you know, in adharma. Just in the society, socially, in our family situation and everything. There's so much that needs to be unraveled. So many, many hurts that need to be unraveled. Right? But all of those hurts have their basis in self-ignorance. So the good thing is we can remove the self-ignorance. Right? If we remove the self-ignorance, then the mind has gained the home of the self which is full. And then that gives it a platform to let all of these wounds and misconceptions and problematic ways of thinking and unassimilated and undigested hurts, gives it time, it can all be worked out. You know, in the light of that, in the light of that wholeness. But that self has to be regained. The self that's never been lost has to be regained. The self that's never gone anywhere has to be regained. It's never gone anywhere, but that's the great power of ignorance. Right? Sometimes Swamiji plays that joke of the husband in a home, he's got his wife and a few children, and he's put his glasses on, you know, for his reading. He pushed his glasses up, so the glasses are on his head like this. You know, this is a long joke. I'll do it in 1 second, but Swamiji does it over a long period of time. The guy goes all around, he's getting so irritated, looking all over, where in the heck are my glasses? Where are my glasses? And his two kids come up and they go into the kids. Where are my glasses? What have you kids done with my glasses? And so the kids kind of look at him. And they don't say anything. They just kind of smile at him. We don't know, Dad. he goes to the wife. Where are my glasses? Where are my glasses? I don't know, dear. It goes on and on like that. Finally, somebody tells him, and there they are. There they are. That's our situation, you know, we're wearing the glasses and we've lost our glasses. We've lost the glasses that we're wearing, you know. We've lost the self that we are. That's why there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. Nowhere to go. There's just some ignorance to be removed. And it's a very powerful. Moving ignorance, everything changes. Everything changes. Without the ignorance being removed, it's still operating under its spell. Yeah. That's why when we say between knowledge and liberation, it's a matter of ignorance. It's removing the ignorance. It's not a matter of doing anything. It's a matter of coming to class. Coming to class means being in a situation where that ignorance can be removed. So that's something doing, but once you get to that pramana, where that means of knowledge is taking place, then what do you do? You know, it's like the example that if I open my eyes and I'm looking at the painting, I am going to see the painting. And if my mind is there, the eyes are there, and the painting is there, now say I like that, what am I going to do to see the painting? I can't not see the painting. Yourself is there. Right? The means of knowledge is there, yourself is there, your mind is there, you can't not see. There's nothing to do except to get yourself into that situation because you're already what you seek. See what I mean? Okay, let's stop there for a minute. Let's take a minute. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. There's so many different types of thoughts. Like there's just perceptions, and then there's memory, and then there's just the nature of how the mind works through the law of association. So like, for instance, one thought generates just one thought, any thought. Like if I say, obvious, if I say hot, it'll generate cold, usually. And that will generate something else. And so that law of association just keeps the mind going. And so if you understand that, then there's kind of, in a sense, a meaningless thought flow, unless you want to start doing experiments like Jung did, you know, to see that meaningless, that just generation of self-generating thought flow, and then there would be a little pause where all of a sudden there was an association taking place, and we do work like that to get into the unconscious. You know, to see where complex is for. So To look at the mind in terms of discovering complexes or parts of the thought flow that cause pain is useful. You know, that can be useful. Or to, if you have a painful thought, to try to go to the source of the pain, that can be useful. But to try to figure out what is kind of the purpose of the mind or what generates the mind in the first place, it's beginningless.
Yeah.
So I don't think so. But in order to understand it in terms of pain, what produces pain is helpful. What type of associations, what type of unconscious processes are there? Because we don't want pain. None of us want. We would like to help the mind. It's natural that just like you want to, if your body's in pain, you want to help it to get out of pain. The same with the mind. If the mind is in pain or anxious or behaving in a pattern or something that's painful, you want to help it as much as you can. Ignorance removes the fundamental problem that causes this continual samsara, you know, continual hurting itself. You know? So you remove that ignorance, and then you have to kind of, it's helpful to try to help the mind for things that have happened in the past that hurt it, that hurt it.
That if there's recognition that that the sun or light shines, whether it's murky water or rough water or clear water, then that creates a lot of freedom to not change or to manipulate in any way emotion, and there's no power over the emotion then.
You know what? It creates a tremendous amount of freedom to accommodate the mind. It gives a tremendous amount of patience. However, when the mind is behaving in a painful way, it's natural for it to want to fix itself.
You know? But if there's a recognition, it seems like then there would be no trying to fix itself. It would just be okay.
As long as that's true, that's true. You know? But because the mind has a lot of, this is what we call jnanam with pratibandhikas, with obstructions. What it means is, once you've really recognized yourself and your mind has that stable, very stable presence, and you're the same illuminating the mind still can have ways of thinking and feeling that are pain-producing, to create problems in the world, in your interactions. And so it's going to be natural to want to change that. There can also be unconscious things that haven't been worked out that are painful. And so even though, because of yourself, you can be very accommodating of whatever the mind is doing, it's still natural to want to fix it. Right? To say something, say, for instance,
or just eat.
If the mind, the self just is, does just be,
yeah,
that's not going to change, right? Now, if the mind is such that the type of thinking that it's having is fine with it, then it will just be. But if the mind, which is thinking and feeling and whatnot, is creating problems for itself, then the mind will try to fix itself. And all of that is fine. There's nothing wrong with or problematic about the mind trying to take care of itself. It's natural. So it's, you look at it just in the physical organism, it's always trying to take care of itself, you know, to come into balance. And all of that, you can be very patient with all of that and very helpful and very supportive. With your knowledge, once you know yourself is constant. If there's knowledge there, yourself is the constant, then the buddhi, the one who has the knowledge, recognizing the constant self itself, can be very kind and very patient and helpful to all of the different, what we call samskaras and tendencies in the mind, hurts in the mind, just to help it along. The mind doesn't just change overnight.
Right.
Yeah. And so there's an attitude of care.
And it seems freedom.
Well, there's tremendous freedom because yourself isn't going anywhere.
and no attachment to the emotion, maybe. Or
it's not even a, well, well, by non-attachment, there's different meanings to that.
Identification. I mean, identification.
There's not an identification with anything. Never. Once yourself is known, yourself is yourself. It's always the same. However, the mind can still be looping around with pain and problems or ways of working in the world that are not, haven't really risen up to your understanding. And the buddhi, the intellect that knows, that intellect is patient with that mind because it understands. It gives it time to grow. It doesn't expect that now you know yourself, and so all of these myriad of connections and kind of and behaviors in the mind immediately change. They don't. But there's somebody there that's okay with that and handles it and helps it along. Yeah. Patient. You know, if you raise a child, say for instance, you know, you can't expect that little child to do everything perfectly. It grows and it learns and matures and, you know, grows into a good little person. And so, I was just thinking what my sister and I went through when she was raising her kids to those teenage years. We'd always remind ourselves, you know, these kids were young. They were beautiful, little, wonderful. They're just in a rough patch right now. They will be okay. But they're, you know, you would love them. So your mind, you know, it has to grow and mature to whatever degree it does. If it doesn't have to, means you've done so much work and whatnot before you came to knowledge. It already has worked through a lot of its traumas and problems growing up. It doesn't have to do any of that. And that's great. But if it does have to do that, that's fine too. And luckily you have knowledge, and so you can help it along. Just like you help other people. Say you have knowledge. You know yourself. You help other people. You can help the mind also. It's kindness. Rather than thinking you're supposed to be such and such and such and such and such and such. The only thing that you is the one way is yourself. So that's the only thing that's non-dual. Everything else is very, very complicated. You know what I mean? I mean, it's networked. Everything else within the creation is so networked. It's so influenced and interrelated by so, so many things. You know, that it takes time for it to sort itself out, to work itself out, so that it's not responding to the world in pain-producing ways. So if you get knowledge, it gets rid of a lot of the fun, a lot of the problems are just wiped out.
But you need a kind of a normally functioning mind for this knowledge to make itself. I mean, like, just as an easy question.
Well, it's true.
Mentally, if you've got some mental illness, that the presence, the real, the true self is still there,
but the mind
faculties are not available to.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how problematic the mind is. Yeah, if say the person's very, well, I don't know.
Bipolar.
Well, you can be bipolar, you can, you know, but and still gain knowledge. But your mind has to be available. The mind has to be available. The mind's the one that has the huge problem. It has to be available. You know, I think that, you know, you can't just say even the person's a schizophrenic or they are bipolar. Bipolar, I won't even count that. That's, a lot of people are bipolar. That's not a...
We all are to varying degrees, right?
But say they have schizophrenic or there's some serious problems. That doesn't mean they can't know. Hmm. It depends. If they can't know, if the problem is such that their mind's not available, then they can't. Hmm. But to say, oh, somebody's not smart enough or they have mental problems or this or that, therefore they can't know, I wouldn't make that determination. that determination has to make itself. I mean, it could be true that the person is mentally retarded to the degree that they're not able to follow anything, you know, or that they're psychotic to the degree that they can really cannot distinguish. But I had a schizophrenic patient once who really had done a lot with his mind. No, you know, you can't just say that they can't know. But it makes it harder.
Or somebody with ADD.
ADDs can definitely know.
What's ADD?
Attention deficit disorder. But they have to really be interested. ADD, you have to have really want to know that. Then you can focus.
So I have some clarity around the asanga.
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 Because
When I hear that word, unattached, I think it becomes some kind of a spiritual idea, you know, being unattached.
Yeah, I'm not trying, when we say,
like,
yeah, asanga, I'm not using as vairagya. When we say vairagya, that dispassion means everything's like the helium balloon for me as an adult. I'm not attached. But when we say asanga, it's just like more like space. Say this is a clay pot in my hand, and I'm moving it through space, right? The pot is, there's no pot space really. If I move a pot from point A to point B, then am I moving the pot space from point A to point B? Saying there is no pot space, really, because the space is asanga. It's not attached. It's not attached to the pot, right? You see what I mean? So pot, the space isn't moving. So now here, in asanga, in reference to myself, and the mind, the self is asanga. It's not moving. It's not going anywhere. The thoughts are taking place in it, in and through it, but it is not changing. It's not attached. It's not a thought takes the self with it. That's what we mean by asanga. So your being can't be taken away, you know, or manipulated or changed in any way because it's asanga. That's a lot different than thinking of dispassion or vairagya towards, you know, because I am the source of my ananda, I don't need this object in order to be happy. That's vairagya. And sometimes that's really misunderstood. It's a lot different to say that I don't need this object to be happy than to say, you know, I shouldn't have that object, or keep that object away from me, or something like that. It doesn't. It's also not saying that object can't make me happy. That object can make me happy. I can have a good time with that object. I can have a great time with that person. That person, that object, that situation can give me a great deal of joy. But when that object goes, I'm not unhappy, because my wholeness, my well-being, is not dependent on the object. If that's vairagya, it's like, when we use the helium balloon for idea, how you say you're with your child, you have a helium balloon for yourself and you got one for your child, so you both get one. Okay? You can both have a great time playing with the balloon, but you have nothing at stake. If you lose the balloon, that's fine. You had a great time with it while you had it. The child loses the balloon. That's a little different. I just said, yeah, wow. Okay. But both can have fun. Both can enjoy. Both can love. Both can be engaged. But one person, the jnani, their well-being is not dependent. And that well-being is asanga. The well-being itself is asanga. That's the nature, that's your Swarupa, and that's never going to change. And so, and the experience of bliss or happiness or joy has for its sole source, not one of the sources, its sole source is that self. It's just like the sole source of the sun's reflection in the water is the sun. That's the only source. It's not, there's not another source. The source of the, for the mind, its experience of ananda, of wholeness, is only the self. And that experience is manifest, in a sense, in the mind, reflected in the mind, in the way that the mind reflects it, right? When the mind is calm and happy. And so not only do you just simply enjoy your own presence, which is a sangha, right? The mind is not dependent on objects for the depth of happiness in terms of its own experience of happiness.
So it's almost like saying the mind is going out for happiness.
For the Ajnani. It's searching out, yes, yes.
Yeah. That's what they mean, the mind is going out.
Yeah. Oh, there, that I need that to be happy.
Yeah.
Right. Even though there's no such thing as going out in terms of a way for the self, but that's what it thinks. I need that object in order to be happy.
And that's such a strong...
The whole world, they, oh, it guides
the
world.
World functions, you know?
That's samsara. The whole world is functioning. That is the great illusion, right? Then everybody's caught in it. So it's mass hypnosis. Mass, you know, ignorance. And that's why it works so well. And I mean, it's a fantastic trick. It's a brilliant trick. I mean, look at how it works. I mean, you fulfill a desire. So I want that object so I can be happy. You believe that. You get the object, the mind relaxes, you experience happiness. So why shouldn't you think from the object? It has nothing to do with the object at all. And eventually you figure it out. Eventually you figure it out because you realize that the happiness that I wanted I experienced for a minute, you know, but the object remains, happiness goes. Right? So the object and the happiness have no relationship with each other, really. There's so many things in the universe make you, so many of your experiences, eventually you realize there's something funny going on here.
Interesting, yeah. Because like the experience of happiness is experienced here
always,
you know, so
as myself,
yeah.